Okay, and thanks, Antoine, for inviting me. I've never been to the ITP before. I've been to Santa Barbara before, but only as a tourist, and so now I get to be both a physicist and a tourist. So I figured a physics talk has to have a bad pun in it, and so I chose it for my title. This sort of populist title has a lot more to it than just an indication that I, an experimentalist, is going to teach you, the unwashed theorists, about the femtosecond spectroscopy. It actually evokes also the idea that what I'm going to be talking mostly about initially is the use of a particular technique in femtosecond spectroscopy called time domain terahertz spectroscopy, and how that can be used to obtain information about the effective mass of carriers in metals generally, and the particular case that I'm going to be talking about is strontium-ruthenium-03. Unfortunately, there's a whole series of oxides with ruthenium in them in the Ruddleston-Popper series, and they all go by strontium-ruthenate. They all have the same charge state. So strontium-ruthenate is strontium-ruthenium-03. It's also strontium-2-ruthenium-04, which is probably a better-known one because of its superconductivity, and so on. And finally, the last idea that I want to get across with this title is that really, over the last 15 years or so, the laser engineers who have been working on femtosecond lasers have really been doing a phenomenal job, not only at pushing the boundaries of what we can accomplish with these lasers, but also in commercializing the technology so that people like myself and others who are not, you know, really laser engineers but are interested in using them can actually go ahead and buy some of these lasers, or in the case of one of the lasers that we use in our studies in the lab, you can buy as a kit, and I had an undergraduate build it in about a month. So just to give you a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about, I'll give you a very brief introduction to femtosecond spectroscopy, and I'll give you more as the talk goes on. And then I'll motivate my discussion of strontium-ruthenium-03. After all, this is a conference or a workshop on realistic theories of strongly correlated electron systems, and so I want to give you a sort of back-of-the-envelope kind of picture as to what the electronic structure of this material is like and why we think it's interesting. And then I'll spend a good fraction of the time talking about time-domain terahertz spectroscopy and how we use it to obtain information about the carrier dynamics in strontium-ruthenate. And then I'll summarize what I've said about that topic. And again, because of the workshop environment, I'm just going to, time allowing, touch on other aspects of femtosecond spectroscopy that may be of interest to you. And you should feel free to stop me throughout the talk. So in general, what do modern lasers provide us that the conventional light sources that you would use in infrared spectroscopy don't? Well, they're all the sort of standard things. Intensity, in the case of temporal and spatial coherence, this is something that is going to be a big part of what I'm going to be talking about in the time domain terahertz spectroscopy. Now we have something that older lasers didn't have to nearly the degree. We now have tunability of these sources over from milli electron volts to several eV. And actually, if you really want to include all the variety of techniques, you can get up into X-rays. And people are using these lasers also to generate neutron sources and that sort of thing. Temporal resolution is obtained in the femtosecond lasers because you have a finite pulse. And then, as I indicated earlier, they're actually relatively easy to use. And the way we generate our frequencies and our pulses relies on a whole slew of nonlinear optical techniques, including the conventional and more familiar sum and difference frequency generation, where you just take two photons in and you get the same photons out plus their sums and differences. You can mix frequencies up and mix them down into the infrared. There's also a really kind of a neat phenomenon that if you have a femtosecond lab nearby, I encourage you to go and take a look at it. It's called white light generation, where essentially it's like overdriving. In some sense, it's like overdriving a stereo amplifier. there's a phenomenon that starts out as self-phase modulation, and there's a cascade of other processes that get involved. But if you send in a very strong single frequency light pulse into a hunk of sapphire, you basically get a pulse of really white light coming out the other side that still has all the temporally localized properties of your original pulse. So it's a little bit spread out because of the dispersion in the sapphire, and because it's such a broadband pulse. And then if you really want to get further down into the infrared, it's common to use parametric generation and amplification. Yes? Sapphire. Yeah, so basically the initial part of the process is that there's the Kerr effect, which means that the electric field of the pulse is changing the index of refraction of the sapphire. And that index of refraction change is changing with the electric field, and that creates a phase modulation of the pulse as it goes through the medium. And it's a phase modulation that's induced by itself. So it's called self-phase modulation. And that broadens the pulse. I'm sorry? What you need is that you need the phase of the wave to be modulated large enough that you can get the blue and the infrared. It covers from about 400 nanometers out to a micron, and it's bright white, and it comes out in a collimated like a laser beam. And then if you have a kilohertz laser, which a lot of these lasers that are used for this have a repetition rate of about a kilohertz. And if you stand in front of it and with the room lights out and take a white card and just scan it back and forth in the beam, you can actually see the localization of the pulses in space. It's as I said, I encourage you to look at it if you have an opportunity. It's really fun. I wish I could. You're all welcome to come and visit. And so parametric generation and amplification, as I indicated, and then this isn't exactly a coherent process, but it is something that I'm going to be talking about in great detail. It's called the Austin switch, in which you basically can take a biased photoconducting antenna, and if you zap it with a femtosecond laser, then you get, for the very short period of time that the laser pulse is incident on the photoconductor, you get current flowing. And because you have a very short current pulse, that generates, it's like a Hertzian dipole, it generates a very short electric field pulse that actually is radiated out the backside of the sapphire wafer on which the structure is deposited. And then you can shape this with mirrors and treat it as if it were an optical pulse, although it actually contains frequencies in the terahertz regime. So now, this is a schematic of basically all of the frequencies that are now accessible via modern femtosecond laser sources, all with a temporal duration of about 200 femtoseconds or less. Obviously, in the case of in the very low frequency regime, this number has to be a bit bigger because the frequency or the period of the oscillation is starting to get larger than that. But basically, all of this is covered, and the low frequency regime is covered mostly by time domain terahertz spectroscopy. DFG is for difference frequency generation. OPA is optical parametric amplification. The continuum is that white light generation that I was describing. And then the titanium sapphire laser itself has a fairly broad tunability. And if you want to convert these frequencies or these energy scales into temperatures, this is the scale on the bottom here is the one that you want to look at. And so what's useful in the context of this talk is that the regime covered by time domain terahertz spectroscopy is exactly the regime and temperature of interest to us who are studying the low temperature properties of materials. And so I'm going to now launch into a discussion of strontium-ruthenium oxide, but I want to start with just a brief prelude of what's to come and why we're going to be talking about it. Kostick in Zach Schlesinger's group, just north of us here, observed in this material that the conductivity had a lot of similarity to what's observed in the optimally doped coupe rates. It has a power law decay that's not the 1 over omega squared that you expect for a conventional Drude form. In fact, it decays as more like 1 over the square root of omega, and that's this dashed line here is his fit to 1 over square root of omega. And this is at 40 Kelvin, and then this middle temperature here, I think, is 150 Kelvin, where the material becomes ferromagnetic. This is a ferromagnetic metal with a transition temperature of about 150 degrees. It varies depending on what form it comes in. And then you can see at 250 Kelvin is this lower curve. It starts to develop a pseudogap as well. I'm going to be concentrating mostly on the low temperature regime here. The pseudogap is interesting, but I'm not going to be discussing it in any detail here. And there's there's actually some recent work on this pseudogap, both in strontium ruthenium oxide and calcium ruthenium oxide, by a group in Korea. It came out in PRB just this year. So to come back to the conductivity, the frequency dependence is 1 over square root of omega, indicating that there's a large excess conductivity at high frequencies here. And if you use the conventional notation, as that I'll discuss later, for the scattering time, the frequency dependent scattering rate, that also follows a linear dependence with the frequency, just as the coupe rates. 150 degrees Kelvin. It looks like the pseudogap crosses over to more coherent motion at about that temperature, although I can't say definitively. It's roughly where the pseudogap goes away. There's also, you can see in the DC resistivity, I think because I'm concentrating on the frequency dependence here, I don't have a slide that shows the DC resistivity. There's a lot of interesting stuff about that. And there's the conventional Fischer-Langer cusp at TC, where the spin fluctuations freeze out and you get a very abrupt change in the temperature dependence of the resistivity. So you can see it in the resistivity directly. Now, at low temperatures, this nonetheless it obeys the conventional Fermi liquid form, and it also exhibits quantum oscillations. This is work that Andy McKenzie, who studied a wide variety of these ruthenium compounds, has shown. But there's an interesting thing about this Fermi liquid form. It's that this B factor, which is the prefactor and indicates in some sense what the effective mass of the carriers is. Yes, that's right. I'm sorry. It's actually I've forgotten the name for it. It's Shubnikov de Haas, which is the electrical, the resistivity. Okay, I thought you said the magnetization. I was thinking, oh, have I got it mixed up? Yeah, it's Shubnikov de Haas. The magnetization is difficult with this because it's ferromagnetic, and it's got very strong magnetic anisotropy. So the conventional de Haas van Alphen measurements, to my knowledge, have not been done, if they've been done, it's very difficult to do. So the Shubnikov de Haas is what was done on this material, because the resistivity is much easier to measure. This is a three-dimensional material, as I'll get to in a moment. Can I move on? So this B factor here, if you put in conventional numbers, would indicate that the Fermi temperature is only 10 Kelvin. Now that really just implies that the nature of the relationship between this B factor and the specific heat gamma is different. And if you actually plot this on the so-called Kadowaki-Woods plot, this particular material fits very nicely on the heavy fermion line. So it's just that the prefactor that relates this to the specific heat mass is different than it is for conventional metals.
So then you can launch gamma.
The gamma enhancement is only about 4. Yeah. But yeah, it's large, it can't be phonons. In this particular sample, the residual resistivity is, if I'm not mistaken, it's about 10 microohms centimeters on that particular sample studied here. The best samples available, you can get down to 2 or 3 microohms centimeters. Right. This just runs off the plot at the low temperatures, and that's actually what I'm going to be focusing on later, is that the reflectivity becomes very difficult to do in the low frequency regime, and so we're going to turn to terahertz at the low frequencies. Okay, so just a brief introduction to the electronic structure here. Strontium ruthenium oxide is a conventional perovskite structure. This one's three-dimensional. And ruthenium, if you look at where it sits in the periodic table, it sits right underneath iron. It's in the 4D series, so the orbitals are bigger. Therefore, the Coulomb energy associated with putting two electrons on a site is a little bit smaller than it would be in the 3D series. And it's also better able to hybridize with its nearby oxygen orbitals. If you look at what the ionic picture would tell you about how this material would behave, because of this strong hybridization associated with these large orbitals, there's a huge ligand field splitting between the orbitals of EG symmetry and T2G symmetry. It's of order of about 2 eV in this case, whereas it's a fraction of an eV in conventional 3D electron materials. And of course, it has oxygen orbitals nearby, and I'm limiting in my little schematic here, limiting myself to the pi bonding orbitals, which, as you can see in the upper right here, are the ones that are involved in the bonding most effectively for the T2G orbitals. And if you take an ionic picture, you would have a 4 plus ion, so you have 4 electrons left to put into these orbitals. And because of this large splitting, you put the first 3 in, spin up according to Hund's rules. And the next one, you don't put into the EG orbital, you actually put it in to the T2G orbital with spin down. The energy cost associated with that is lower than the energy cost of putting it into the EG orbital. And you'll notice now that the oxygen atom can actually, if it wants to hybridize with this orbital in a more covalent picture, then this spin-down electron can actually hop over to this into this spin-down site and form a bond. And in fact, if you look at the local spin density calculations of this and other ruthenium materials, and then project out one site and see what the occupancy of that ruthenium site is, they find that there are actually closer to five electrons on that ruthenium orbital, and one of the electrons is actually, or one of the holes, if you will, in this picture is actually on the oxygen site. And so if you want to think about what the electrons are actually in this, in the upper right hand corner here, I'm drawing things in a whole picture, in a simplified view, you put one hole on each and every oxygen and ruthenium site, and then you forget about the EG orbitals because they're above the Fermi level, and you focus only on the T2G ruthenium orbitals and the pi bonding oxygen orbitals, and you put one hole into each. And then you'll notice that there's a good reason why it becomes ferromagnetic, because if the ruthenium ions have anti-ferromagnetic polarization, then this hopping between, then this oxygen hole can't hop to either site, it can only hop to one. So the ferromagnetism is a classic sort of lowering of the kinetic energy associated with the confinement that you normally get in an ionic picture. And it's very close, actually, to how Hubbard, I think, originally envisioned ferromagnetism as a simple competition between potential energy and kinetic energy. And just as a side note on that, all of the other ferromagnetic materials all the conventional elemental ferromagnetic materials have other SP bands that cross the Fermi level. Whereas here, the magnetic bands are the only ones that cross the Fermi level. So it's a very good system to study the effect of magnetic fluctuations on the transport in the magnetic bands, because that's all you have. So now here's the band structure that you would get from that in a more sophisticated picture. Well, so the TC it depends on what picture you mean. I mean, the picture that I just showed you, you don't really get anything quantitative. You mean from the LSDA picture?
Perhaps you should elaborate again what say a little more about how you obtain the ferromagnetism here and how you imagine why this is ferromagnetic.
Okay, so basically you imagine that you take the ionic picture here, and there's going to be some energy cost to putting this hole onto that site.
Right, which is the charge transfer gap.
Right. Which in this case is actually, I guess, it's a bit weird to talk about charge transfer gaps, because here this is happening spontaneously. So in some sense the charge transfer energy is negative. It actually wants to transfer the energy. I mean, it does this naturally. It's not like you start with an insulator and then you dope it. This is automatically doped in its stoichiometric form. So to know precisely what the charge transfer energy is less straightforward than it would be in an insulator. I suppose it could be positive and then it's counterbalanced by this kinetic energy lowering, but to be honest, I don't know what those numbers are. But let's even say that it's positive. And then the oxygen can actually transfer this electron over into the ruthenium orbital at some energy cost, but it lowers the entire system energy, the entire kinetic energy of the system, because the electrons can now flow freely through the crystal and their wave functions are a little bit bigger. So that's the essence of how I'm describing this, and in some sense that's also Stoner's picture of how this. Right. 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 And I'll get to that. Does that answer your question? Or it's 1.6 Bohr magnetons in single crystals. It's a little bit lower in thin films, measured. Now, it's a little bit controversial, to be honest, because the spin-orbit coupling is so strong here that there's very strong magnetocrystalline anisotropy. So a lot of people get lower values of about 1.1. But my interpretation of that is that they're not saturating the crystal entirely along one direction, and the 1.1 is just an indication that they're not saturated. Not to my knowledge. In this material, it's been done in other ruthenates, but I don't know about the 113. Yeah, I'm not aware of it in the 113, but I know it's been done in others. It would be nice to see that, and there's been, there have been oral reports of neutron data that show this, and it's never been published to my knowledge. It would be nice to see this oxygen polarization, but at the moment all we have are, if you find something in the literature, and please let me know, but to my knowledge, all we have to support this picture at the moment are its agreement with other aspects of the experimental picture.
Is it
It is distorted. I'm showing you the cubic structure, and it develops an orthorhombic distortion. And then calcium ruthenate, which is the same, it's basically chemically identical to the strontium, but a bit smaller, that induces an even stronger distortion. So the strontium ruthenium oxide is nearly cubic, sort of pseudo-cubic, and the orthorhombicity is fairly weak. Calcium ruthenate, that's no longer true. You get very strong distortions, and that completely wipes out the ferromagnetism. Yeah, and tilts. And no, I'm sorry, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't have that number in my head. I can give you a reference if you're interested. Okay, so Gabby, have I answered your questions? Okay. So to get back to the band structure, David Singh did the first band structure of this material in 96. And what I'm showing you here, for simplicity, are the bands associated with the idealized cubic structure. And then the density of states on the right-hand side are for the orthorhombic structure. And there are a couple of things that I want to point out about these bands. First of all, you can see that there's this large splitting between the EG bands up here and the T2G bands down here. Now, in this case, the EG bands just slightly cross the Fermi level. But if you introduce the distortion, that actually pushes the bands. These are the EG bands on the right-hand side here. It pushes those EG bands above the Fermi level, so they don't participate. The T2G bands are actually they're relatively broad. The full bandwidth is about 3 eV, but it's actually not as broad, let's say, as the cuprate sigma bonding orbitals, and that's essentially just the difference between sigma bonding and pi bonding. The pi bonding configuration produces a somewhat lower hopping and lower consequent bandwidth. So if you're going to look at the second moment of the bandwidth, basically the second moment of this density of states here, it's actually only about an EV. And yet the splitting between the bands, which are basically the similar, they were originally drawn as dark and light lines for majority and minority spin. They don't show up as well here. But the splitting here is about half of an EV. It depends on where you are in the band and in what orbital, in what band you're in. So basically, you have a very strong exchange splitting and a relatively narrow bandwidth. And in that sense, it's comparable, or it's similar, I would say, to how the cuprates behave, although this is a ferromagnetic material, and the analogy isn't perfectly precise. The magnetic moment that's predicted for the orthorhombic structure is almost dead on at 1.6 Bohr magnetons, and that's exactly what's measured at the Stanford group's single crystals. And as I indicated before, 1.4 Bohr magnetons is what we measure for the thin film samples. I'm using the second moment of the. This is in Rydberg's down here, and so it's basically the coincides. There's this X point. The T2G bands and the EG bands, if I'm not mistaken, are degenerate. So I think it's a peculiarity of the X point. Well, presumably, I haven't seen those spaghetti diagrams, essentially, I would presume that some of these end up that you would get a level splitting, level crossing, anti-crossing, and it just goes up. Right. I should also mention that when you add spin-orbit coupling, which has also been done, that further splits the EG and T2G. So everything that you do pretty much brings the EG bands above the Fermi level. Okay, and these flat bands I want to draw your attention to also, because the T2G, the 4D orbitals have XY, YZ, and XZ, and each of those, all of the bands associated with one, let's say you have let's say this band is associated with the XY orbital, then the coupling between planes, between XY, say a plane and one XY plane and an XY plane just above it, is relatively weak. And so although it's a fully three-dimensional system, in many ways the electronic structure is like interpenetrating sheets that are then crossing at the at particular points in the Brillouin zone. It's more like a, it's not exactly like a Fermi sphere. It's actually, the bands have much more two-dimensional character to them. And that's also similar to the band structure, if I'm not mistaken, of nickel, the d orbitals in nickel. So it's basically just a consequence of the T2G bonding in this system. It's just the same as nickel. So now, I really want to emphasize that this picture really gets the ground state properties very well. And especially in the field of correlated electron systems where band theory is much maligned, I think it bears emphasis that the band theory gets strontium ruthenium oxide, calcium ruthenium O3, and strontium 2 ruthenium O4 almost dead on. And in particular, the strontium 2 ruthenium O4, the ground state properties have been examined in excruciating detail with quantum oscillations, and just about everything is accurate. So, in that with that, you know, caveat, I'm going to launch into a discussion of how things don't fit into our conventional single electron point of view about this material. Yeah.
I have a question about Enstom. You put a paper by Allen.
Yeah, that's right, Phil Allen.
Oh, Phil Allen.
Phil Allen. It's not Jim Allen. It's basically, he was, I think, on sabbatical in Switzerland and organized a group of experimentalists and experimental data and band theory and put together a paper on general properties of this material in PRB from 96.
So when you say estimated,
that's from specific heat.
That's what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Well,
it doesn't. I mean, this effective mass is so. As I said, I mean, I wanted to draw your attention to the successes, and now I'm going to into areas where we don't understand.
The band mass could be very different than the vector mass, right?
No, this is based on the density of states from the, so this effective mass. Maybe I should have put MB here. I'm sorry.
It's compared with LDA.
Yeah, that's a typo. I'm sorry. Right.
You're saying the Fermi surface.
Well, the shape of the Fermi surface, it's a fairly complicated Fermi surface, and you can't compare it in detail to the Shubnikov-De Haas. It's too difficult. And you don't have the nice two-dimensionality that you have in the 214, where you really can do that. In the Shubnikov-De Haas oscillations, there are some odd frequencies that appear that at least at the time when the measurements were done were unexplained, but I don't know if anybody's really gone to great lengths to try and tie those loose ends up. There's been valence band photoemission on it, and that shows that the density of states is reduced from what you would expect from the band theory, and that's by something like a factor of 10. That's very early work by Goodenough that was done, and it's been subsequently confirmed. So the valence band photo emission indicates that the density of states is much lower than what you would predict from the band structure. The effective mass indicates that the density of states is higher. These are all sort of characteristic signs that correlations are at work. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually, can I ask another
Yeah,
question?
Sure.
You mentioned
this
relativity
of
the
square. Yeah. Yeah.
What is the characteristic temperature at which the relativity reaches a Martian day and becomes a bad metal?
So, It depends on whether you put in these two pi's or not. If you don't put in the two pi, you get a crossing at about 500 Kelvin. Yeah.
So it remains a rather good metal.
Oh, it goes straight through. It has maybe I misunderstood your question. The resistivity in this material starts out T squared.
Yeah.
Then it hits TC, where it basically is going up and then its slope decreases. Okay. Then it continues upwards, not a bit sublinearly. It actually fits fairly well to a square root of temperature behavior. So it goes up sublinearly as far as we can go, about 1,000 Kelvin.
You are saying it's going to be 90 extracted in the
it becomes
in range.
It would a mean free path would at 50 Kelvin would be reasonably large. Yeah, sure. Around TC, it would still be a couple of lattice constants. It becomes one lattice constant well above TC. So this is a bad metal in the sense that you can trace its temperature dependent resistivity through the Mott limit without observing any characteristic saturation or anything like that. Yeah. No more questions? I'll move on. Okay, so just to give you a sense for the playing field here with ruthenates, calcium ruthenate is a paramagnetic metal. It has an anti-ferromagnetic Weiss temperature, so it actually has fairly strong. And in a lot of these, a lot of the band structures of these materials do exhibit nesting. So there's, even though some of them are ferromagnetic, there's quite a bit of evidence that all of them show anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations at the same time that the dominant fluctuations are ferromagnetic. Strontium ruthenium oxide is, as I've told you, is ferromagnetic and it's metallic. The one failure of the LDA in this series is calcium ruthenate, where again the calcium causes this strong distortion. And this is an antiferromagnetic insulator with an AL temperature of about 110 Kelvin. And the LDA, while it indicates that there should be an antiferromagnetic instability, nonetheless predicts metallic behavior. The strontium 2 ruthenium 04, I think you probably all know, it's a very promising example of unconventional superconductivity. A lot of evidence that it's P wave and triplet, spin triplet. Calcium ruthenium oxide 327 is an antiferromagnetic that also exhibits a metal insulator transition. I don't know what the band structure says about that, but it's quite likely that it also fails there as well. The 327 is a paramagnetic metal and has recently been in the news because of its metamagnetism, and Andy McKenzie in collaboration with a theoretical collaboration with Andy Millis identified the possibility of a metamagnetic quantum critical endpoint in this material. I can talk more about that with people if they're interested. This one here, the 113. No, it's paramagnetic. But if you look at the susceptibility as a function of temperature, it extrapolates to a negative temperature. So it has a negative Weiss temperature, indicating that it's without evidence from neutrons. It's some evidence that you have antiferromagnetic fluctuations. It's a tricky business to do these extrapolations, so it shouldn't be taken as the gospel truth, but it does suggest antiferromagnetic fluctuations. Okay, so now let's go to talking about the optical conductivity of this material. This is something I expect you probably can tell me a lot about. If you take a Mott insulator and you have sort of like I think of this as a quantum gridlock, where you have bunch of cars in a parking lot, and they can't sit on top of each other, so they've got to go into the vacant spaces, and that slows everyone down. thing that happens in electrons that is indicated by this gray shaded region here is that fortunately doesn't happen with cars is that the lifetime is modified as well by this process. Well, maybe it is modified a little bit, but not as drastically. Yeah. So you have a modification of the spectral function of the electrons in this material that's associated with the Coulomb repulsion. And while we call them heavy electrons, for the purposes of this talk, it's better to think of heavy as meaning slow, because the mass is defined as the Fermi momentum divided by the Fermi velocity. The bands are modified near the Fermi level, so the velocity goes down, and therefore the mean free scattering time also goes up with the mass. Now, when that happens, if you look at the Drude peak and the conductivity, that means that the Drude peak has to narrow, but then there's an F-sum rule for optics that tells you that you can't lose spectral weight under this curve, and so you have to push that up to higher frequencies. Okay? And as I indicate in the references here, this is something that I'm sure everyone here is familiar with. So now, our measurement is going to extract that scattering time, the renormalized scattering time, from a measurement of the imaginary part of the conductivity. And this is where the coherence of our technique is going to come into play. Because, as I'll show you in a moment, time domain terahertz spectroscopy is a fully coherent technique. You get both amplitude and phase information from your measurement, and therefore you can extract out directly the real and the imaginary part of the transmission amplitude and thereby the conductivity. And if you expand the conductivity in terms of omega tau, you'll find that at the low frequency limit, tau is just given by the conductivity phase divided by the frequency. So the conductivity phase in the low frequency limit just increases with a slope of tau. And you can't extract this information out about the renormalized scattering time from a measurement of the simple DC resistivity, because both of these quantities, both the scattering time and the mass, should be renormalized by exactly the same amount. And so now, I'd like to ask the question, what happens to anomalous metals when you get into the regime where Fermi liquid theory really should hold well? We can't do that in high temperature superconductors because they go superconducting at below about 100 Kelvin. And so you really can't get into this low frequency, low temperature asymptotic regime. Whereas strontium ruthenium, one of the reasons we chose it for our study is that it's metallic all the way down and you can actually focus on this narrow issue as to the Fermi liquid properties. The infrared reflectivity shows this anomalous power law form down to about 60 wave numbers, which is about 2 terahertz here. And the accuracy of the reflectivity becomes poorer and poorer for reasons that I'll describe as you get lower and lower in frequency, essentially because the reflectivity is just getting closer and closer to 1, and measuring deviations from 1 is experimentally difficult. And so what I'm going to now ask is, how does this conductivity cross over into the DC limit? What does it do? And this is important for terahertz spectroscopy because all of the scales, both energy and temperature scales, are coincident with the bandwidth of our measurement. Okay, so here's how we do the experiment. As I indicated before, we have one of these Austin switches. And we have a signal, and we have a source, and we have a detector. And that's indicated here, an emitter and a detector. Both of them are the same device. So I'll describe the emitter first, and then I'll describe how we use the same system to do detection. If we bias this structure so that current flows when this laser pulse is incident on it, then as I indicated before, you have a changing current which generates an electromagnetic field pulse that shoots out the other side. If instead you have an electromagnetic field pulse traveling in to be incident on this device and you leave it unbiased, then when you zap it with the laser, you can, if you time when you zap it with the laser, you can pick off either the leading edge or the trailing edge, depending on how you delay this laser pulse with respect to the incident electric field. When you do that, if there is an electric field present on this device, then current will flow. And so we can detect that current flow with a simple ammeter. The ammeter will have current flowing, let's say, positively when the leading edge is the one that's being gated, and it's negative when the trailing edge is the one that's being gated. So it's basically gated detection with femtos or picosecond gate widths. And the way we control the delays is we take a femtosecond laser and send it through a beam splitter. And the first beam goes up, hits a mirror, and goes into the emitter, which is biased, and then generates the terahertz pulse. That terahertz pulse then travels across this gap at the same time that a second, that the transmitted pulse from this beam splitter goes through a controllable delay line, which is basically just two mirrors on a motorized stage that we can move back and forth. And then this pulse goes up, hits this detector at precisely the moment when this terahertz pulse is hitting the detector antenna. And then in the very narrow range where we actually have an electric field, we scan the delay line here to trace out this pulse. So at each one of the points on this curve in the lower left-hand corner is an experiment where we've parked the delay line at a particular location to measure a particular delay in time. And then we've integrated the current that flows through the antenna, and the driving force for that current is the particular electric field as a function of time that's in this radiating terahertz field. So this is, are there any questions about this part? Because this is, I'm using two different, the upper signal is a schematic and the lower one is the real pulse. The real pulse actually does have a double lobe, and it depends on which emitter you use. The actual shape of this depends in some measure on the geometry of your antenna and the properties of the photoconductor, that kind of thing. Yeah, so it's not tunable, and the reason that it's not tunable is that what we're doing is we're generating a quasi-single cycle pulse in the time domain. So now if you take the Fourier transform of this, which is what's shown on the right-hand side here, the dark line is the amplitude and the dashed line is the phase. This pulse is basically a very broadband pulse. It's got at least a decade of spectral content in it. And it's all coming at you at the same time. So unless you filter it, you're basically getting all of the information at once. And the way you perform a measurement is you look at the attenuation of the time trace. If you look at a time trace and you insert a sample in between the emitter and the detector here, and the transmission amplitude leads to a squashing of this time trace in the electric field axis, or in the current axis, is what we're actually measuring. And then the phase of the transmission amplitude is given by the delay induced in this time trace by putting in your sample. And that's the important point, is that because we know where our zero of time is, we know what the imaginary part of the response function is, in addition to the amplitude. So now, what we're going to do with this is we're going to use this in the transmission geometry, and I want to explain to you why we use transmission and not reflection. If you look at reflection, the reflection amplitude, you can ignore what's in parentheses here, replace it by one. This is your first order approximation to the reflectivity for a metal, and it's given by the so-called Hagen-Rubens form, and it's given by the frequency and the DC conductivity. Okay? So and this is this blue line shown here. And as you go to lower and lower frequencies, this approximation gets better and better and better and becomes indistinguishable from the exact form, which actually contains the information about the quantity of interest, which is the scattering time. So if you're looking at reflectivity, you have to have extraordinarily good accuracy in order to distinguish the green curve from the blue curve. And that can be done above about 2 terahertz here. But as you get lower and lower in frequencies, it becomes harder and harder. And I want to emphasize that this is a distinction between accuracy and precision. It's not enough to simply have a very precise measurement. You actually have to know that your source, that your lamp, is absolutely stable to a part in 10 to the fourth, and that your detector is stable to a part in 10 to the fourth, and that none of this is changing when you change from your sample to your reference in a conventional reflectivity measurement. That's very, very difficult to do. And so our way around this is to use transmission. What we do is we deposit a thin film on a substrate, and then we send our terahertz pulse through that, and we measure the transmission amplitude by comparing the Fourier transforms of the electric field without the sample substrate pair, and then with it. And when we do that, we get this transmission amplitude, which is given simply by Fresnel's equations, really, where n is the index of refraction of the substrate, z naught is the impedance of free space, 377 ohms, d is the thickness of the film, and then sigma of omega is the conductivity, the frequency-dependent conductivity. Now, both the transmission amplitude here and the frequency-dependent conductivity are complex quantities. We're getting both real and imaginary information from this measurement, and therefore we get real and imaginary information about the real and imaginary parts of the conductivity. It's about 1,000. It depends on the DC conductivity of the sample, and in our case, it's about 500 to 1,000 angstroms. Yeah, that's right. Now, since there was, I saw that there was a talk, a set of talks here earlier on superluminal propagation in materials, and there's actually something about that here. In this case, it's really more pulse distortion, I have to say. What we're actually measuring, if you take, again, I'm changing the way I describe the pulse. I'm going from something that has lobes to a Gaussian, just for simplicity. If you look at the, if you take the black curve as your original pulse, and then you, the green curve is a scaled up version of what you would have if you went just through the substrate, and then the pink curve here is the pulse that you would get if you then deposited the film on top of the substrate while it was all in the same geometry. And what you'll notice is that the pulse, the peak of this pulse is actually advanced compared to the unattenuated pulse. And this comes straight out of the equations for the transmission amplitude. It's really just pulse distortion associated with the fact that you're attenuating the beam. There's no electric field. If you were to blow up this leading edge region here, you would find that the electric field is not arriving if the metallic film were not there. It just looks like it is because of the fact that you have the opportunity to look at the entire Gaussian waveform, whereas an atom sitting in the crystal can't, or in the detector can't actually tell the difference until it's all gone through it. So, what I want to evoke by this slide is really that what we're measuring here has a very direct relationship to the scattering time. It's couldn't be more simple, really. We just look at the time that the pulse is advanced. Okay, so I'll just get through the description of our results, and then because it's getting a bit warm in here with all the bodies, I think I'll just finish there, and I can show slides afterwards to people who are interested. So here are the results that we obtain on a film of strontium-ruthenium-03. Now the films that we could obtain on the substrates that were transparent to terahertz have higher residual resistivities than the best ones that are available on strontium titanate. Strontium titanate, unfortunately, is opaque to the terahertz region, so we're constrained to looking at materials which have about a 50 micro-ohm centimeter DC resistivity at low temperatures. So having said that, we actually extract the frequency-dependent conductivity, and here I plot the amplitude and the phase in the upper and lower traces. And then what I'm doing here is I'm fitting what these black lines are fits to this data to a very simple form that we're just using to try and tell us whether we have deviations from Drude or not. And this form is just a constant divided by 1 over, this 1 over tau minus I omega, which would be Drude if alpha were 1. But we know that at high frequencies, alpha is closer to 0.5. So if you look at the high frequency extrapolation of this form, it fits with the pre-existing data. And then we hope that we can tell the difference between a Drude peak at low frequencies or an extrapolation of this high frequency square root of omega kind of behavior. Now this looks like a fairly simple modification, but I want to emphasize how radical it is. What we're doing is we're taking a response function which has a simple pole in the complex plane, and we're replacing that simple pole by a branch cut. Okay, so we're doing radical things to the response function by approximating or by fitting to this form. And what we're going to find is that alpha is not 1, it's in our measurements, it's closer to 0.5, consistent with the measurements out of Schlesinger's group. But down to, well, here's 200 gigahertz. Okay, so we chose this form in some sense for historical reasons. We're interested in this Yaffe-Millis interpretation of the high frequency behavior of the optimally doped Coupe rates. Now, there's no good reason why this should work in this material, but it provided a nice simple form. I guess if you have another form that you would like to propose, I'm happy to try and impose it on the data. But I think although it looks, you know, like it's not a very good fit, a lot of this, you have to keep in mind that there's noise in here. There are systematic errors, especially especially these wiggles here are really associated with the systematics of the measurement. And the wiggles are especially prominent in the phase measurements. All of that is sort of a combination of noise and systematic errors. And then we're fitting this with a fairly small number of parameters. So I would actually say that the fit's reasonably good. And if you look at how these fits behave for while you're varying these parameters, you'd find that this constrains it fairly well. Yeah, I'll get to that. Well, I'll get to that in a moment. Yes, I agree. It might be, and I'll get to the higher frequencies later, and the lower frequencies. Oh, one terahertz is one. That's unusual. One terahertz is 33 wave numbers, and 4 millivolts. And 50 Kelvin, 48 Kelvin. Okay. So I'll walk you through the fits, and then I'll show you how the fits then can be used to tell us more about data outside of this frequency range. So the first thing that you can notice about this form is that the phase of the conductivity is independent of this constant A. Right, and at first, what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow both the parameter A, which has units that depend on what the value of alpha is, and both A and 1 over tau are are going to be temperature dependent, and we're just going to fit both of them freely. And then later on, we're going to constrain A. But the first thing that you will notice is that the conductivity phase is independent of A. And moreover, the scale of the real part of the conductivity is much larger than the scale of the imaginary part of the conductivity. These phase angles are not very large. And yet, the imaginary part of the conductivity is really what we're interested in. So we have to come up with a way of performing this fit in a way that takes that into account. So the way that I'm going to proceed with this fit is to take the phase of the conductivity and fit that to this form to obtain a scattering rate for each temperature. That's this lower curve. And when I do that, I'll pick a particular value of alpha, and that will basically constrain tau for all values of the temperature that we've measured. With those values of the scattering rate in hand, we can then go back up here and look at the amplitude data and obtain parameters A, the A parameters, which are in principle also temperature dependent. And then what we'll do is we'll look at the chi squared values for each of those two fits. Now they have different units, so we're not going to be able to add them simply, but we can use them to guide us in how we think about what's the best value for alpha here. So in the inset, what I'm showing you is the solid line here is the fits to the amplitude, and the dashed lines here are the solid lines are fits to the phase, and then the dashed lines are fits to the amplitude using those values of the scattering time. And what you can, as I indicated, you can't really just add these and get some simple single function of chi squared as a function of alpha, but no matter how you add these to chi squared values, you're never going to get one, because of these amplitude values just become they start deviating too strongly from the data in a systematic way to be able to use this form to explain these data. A better value would be something like 0.3 or 0.4 if you allow yourself to just add these in quadrature, let's say. So that will constrain us somewhat. The next thing that we might ask is, well, what happens if we try and fix A to be a constant, just like it would be in the Drude form? That's a separate question, because all of these fits we've done assuming that tau and A are both temperature dependent. So now we're going to look at the low frequency value of the conductivity amplitude and compare it on a log-log plot to the scattering time to the power alpha. All right, and what this tells us is if this conductivity form is given by a constant A value, then the low frequency conductivity, where you basically set omega equal to zero here, is going to be proportional to tau to the alpha. All right? So the curve that I'm showing you here, the curves that I'm showing you here, one of them is a straight line, and that's is linear. The conductivity is linear with tau to the alpha. And that linear curve is given by alpha equals 0.4. For the other curves, for the other values of alpha, you have to assume some temperature dependence to the A value in addition to the temperature dependence of the scattering rate. So if you want, and then moreover, this alpha value is consistent with our earlier estimates as to what the best fit value for alpha would be. So from these two observations, we conclude that really the best value for alpha, if you're going to use this form to describe the data, is alpha equals 0.4. Now, coming back to your question, what we can do now is we can use these parameters. We've now obtained parameters just from the terahertz data. And now we want to ask, well, how does that behave outside of the bounds of the terahertz? And the first thing that I'll show you is what happens when you extrapolate the results that we've obtained for alpha equals 0.4 and the temperature-dependent scattering rates that we measured, or that we extracted from our fits. So here, these are these dashed black lines here. The dashed colored lines are the results from our terahertz measurements. And the solid colored lines, which cover the regime of a few tens of inverse centimeters, are obtained from infrared transmission measurements on the same films. And then this solid black line here is the low temperature curve from Schlesinger's reflectivity measurements on a different film with somewhat lower residual resistivity. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is that even though we're really looking only in this very narrow regime here, this form, once we've obtained these parameters, predicts reasonably accurately the behavior of this of the conductivity response all the way out to three decades. One wave number is 33 terahertz. If we're up to let's see. Here is 1 terahertz. Okay, so we're going up nearly 2 decades above that. Now this. Yeah, very high frequencies. Okay, so with all of that, it's sort of cute, but it's not necessarily meaningful. If you extract out the temperature dependence of the scattering rate, you can fit that scattering rate to a Fermi liquid form. I mean, this is obviously a non-Fermi liquid form for the conductivity, but if you actually take these values for that we obtain for the scattering rates at different temperatures, the fall off with temperature is very close to this simple Fermi liquid form, where the coherence temperature, if you will, is about 40 Kelvin. Now the reason for this dependence is that the DC resistivity is approximately linear in this regime, and the conductivity's dependence on the scattering time is nonlinear. So it goes more as the square root of the scattering time, and so that's what leads to this recovery of this more conventional form in this unconventional context. This is 5 Kelvin, and this is 80 Kelvin, and we've measured. The data isn't very highly constraining beyond about 150 Kelvin. These data are dominated really by systematic and statistical uncertainties. Okay, right. It does for our films. But this is last point here. Okay, once we publish this, we actually made this statement that if you look at this form, the conductivity does not accurately represent the scattering time. There's a nonlinear relationship, whereas we normally take a linear relationship between the conductivity and the scattering time. And Andy McKenzie took issue with that statement and went and took samples with lower residual resistivities than we could measure, and then used all of our parameters to try and fit. His low temperature resistivity, and he couldn't do it. Okay, so yeah.
So now you are saying, for the new one of us out,
yeah. That's right. This would have to be 0.5, but the bottom line is that. This could be 2 to, if you wanted this to be t squared and you wanted the resistivity to be linear, then alpha should be 0.5, or t squared should be t to the 2.5. But it is quadratic at very low temperatures. But it turns out that if you take this form, because you have this impurity resistivity, this impurity scattering time here, when you take the square root of this quantity at low temperatures, you recover the t squared term. From the t squared is still the lowest term in the Taylor expansion. It's just that high values of t. Yeah. Well, no, it's not always bigger. It's you have two regimes, one where this is bigger at low temperatures, and then you have t squared. The crossover will occur at about 40 Kelvin, or a little bit lower, I think, square root of that. Okay, yeah, so that, thanks for drawing attention to that. That's the sort of bizarre thing about this form is that if you take the square root of this, the impurity, the deviation from the DC impurity limited resistivity is still t squared if you take the square root. And since we're obtaining these values of alpha from Fitts, it's not, the value of alpha is 0.5 is not so much outside of our out of our error bars that you couldn't imagine it. Now, having said all of that, I mean, it should be said that when you apply this form to the lowest residual resistivity samples, it comes up with inconsistencies. All right, so all of this should be taken with a grain of salt. What I really want to emphasize to you is that this form describes remarkably well a particular regime of the behavior of the conductivity of this material that covers several decades in frequency and about a decade in temperature, down to about 5 Kelvin with films of a particular residual resistivity. All right. Now, if you go to lower residual resistivities, it appears that this overall picture breaks down.
What is the smallest residual resistivity for which this reading works?
50 microohm centimeters, 40 or 50.
But
that's
below that.
Well, we haven't performed terahertz measurements on samples below that because we can't obtain them on the substrates that would be transparent to terahertz. I mean, we're working on getting around that problem, but at the moment that's a hard. I mean, so when I say that it doesn't work on anything below 40 microohm centimeters, that's an empirical statement. We just haven't tried it below that. I expect that typically the reason for residual resistivity is not oxygen deficiency. These things are incredibly covalent. They don't give up oxygen. It's very hard to get these to be non-stoichiometric. What does happen is you have different crystalline forms. So you have distortions and you have grain boundaries and they're basically structural defects, but not chemical defects so much. And so the structural defects are the dominant source of scattering, it appears, in these materials. And that's right, because of a lattice mismatch between the film and the substrate. That's better in strontium titanate substrates. But strontium titanate is completely, well, it's not completely opaque, but it has a huge dielectric susceptibility that has an enormous temperature dependence because it has this quantum paraelectric behavior. It's probably the worst substrate that you could imagine for this kind of measurement. It's not just opaque, it will introduce a horrible temperature dependent background into your measurement that you just can't deal with. Okay. That's right. Well, what would happen if you lower tau zero? Essentially, the way to think about the way these curves are behaving is that they, or the way this form behaves is that on this log plot you have a straight line that fits 1/√ω, let's say, or 1/(0.4), and then at a particular temperature, given you get a rate, and when that rate is comparable to omega, then you have a crossover to DC value. So essentially, you have a flat line here, which gives you your DC limit, and where that flat line crosses your power law behavior, that's where you have your crossover, and that's the regime that we've actually measured. Okay, in this material. So the crossover regime in these materials and in this temperature regime is, even if you this, you can see already a little bit of an overshoot here, right? And whereas with our measurements we could attribute that to a systematic, the extrapolation is a little bit different from our measured DC resistivity, but it was not so different that we couldn't attribute it to systematic error. What McKenzie's group did was they measured samples where you really couldn't, you just really can't attribute that to systematic error any longer. And if I could get to the basic point that I'm trying to make here, is that this behavior, I think, is going to be robust at relative, because it's disorder dependent, it's going to be robust at relatively high temperatures, and that's the regime that we've studied. What's going to happen as you go to the DC limit that McKenzie studied is you're going to have an additional crossover where you recover true coherent Fermi liquid behavior. But that regime is incredibly low. Okay? The temperature and frequency scale at which that occurs, I think we have successfully constrained with these measurements to be of the order of, you know, 10 to, let's say it's even 100 inverse centimeters. That's still much, much lower than you would expect for a conventional Fermi liquid. So that's... T squared is obeyed to much lower. It's only about 10 Kelvin where you have that, even in the best samples. No, the best samples. The best samples available. Yeah. So in these samples, you can expect the domain size to be about 400 angstroms, and the mean free path at 250 Kelvin is about 10 angstroms. You would need. I don't think you're really. Yeah, so if you, and it's approximately linear with temperature, even with all the at very low temperatures, that's no longer true. But in the high temperature regime, you can basically just multiply, if you wanted to get from 10 to 400, you have to multiply by 40. And so you'd have to go to fairly low temperatures to really reach a full grain boundary size. But there's a distribution, and in the end, it's a transport measurement. You have to traverse the whole sample, so you know it's a useful number to keep in your head, but it's not necessarily the only consideration when you're trying to assess where you should be. You can actually have pretty good transport even when you have the mean free path. The mean free path is clearly going to be limited by the grain boundaries when you're at that limit, but it's still going to be influenced by the grain boundaries well below that limit, well below mean free paths that you're talking about. Okay, so. Yeah, so this is another good point. You'll note that this form and the data, no matter what. I mean, this is also going to be true of the films that McKenzie studied. We don't conserve spectral weight here, at least with the accuracy of the measurements that we've obtained. It's difficult to know whether you could recover it by some small changes to the conductivity at high frequencies, but it seems unlikely.
Without the noise number, it's been pretty low in here.
Right. That's right, yeah. So, if you cut it off below here, it certainly appears that the spectral weight is not conserved and that it's being pushed up to, say, 3 eV is probably a good number to. There's an interband transition at 3 eV that's a likely candidate for that. But if you do extrapolate this up, the plasma frequency that you get is about 1.5 eV. for this entire connectivity. For the plasma frequency, let's see, I used to know that number and it slipped out of my head, I'm afraid. I should go back and check it, but my recollection is that it's not unusually high, the M star over M obtained from that measure. You really have to look at, if you want to see mass enhancement, you have to look at the specific heat and some of those other measurements. To my recollection, the plasma frequency was not an obvious smoking gun, and I don't recall the precise number, but the fact that I don't have it in the earlier slides is already an indication that it's not a smoking gun. Okay, so just to finish with this idea that these are the fits that Mackenzie used, these dashed lines here, to try and fit the solid line, which are his data, and then the lower curve here, which is a thin solid line, are the results that you would get if you took our parameters obtained from this measure of the high frequency conductivity and extrapolated down to the zero frequency regime. So clearly there's a difference between the solid dashed line and or the solid thick line and the thin solid line, and then even if you try and fiddle with the parameters a little bit, you can't recover anything that looks like their data. So, and then moreover, further evidence of Fermi liquid behavior is the Shchibnikov-de-Haas oscillations, which also, if you look at their temperature dependence, they exhibit the conventional Fermi liquid temperature dependence. So I guess I've taken you through a long experimental course, and in some sense this really is, I wanted to present this here because it's unfinished business, and it has implications for the coupe rates. All of the information that we have about the incoherent conductivity in the coupe rates is from high frequencies and high temperatures. And if you look at our films at high frequencies and high temperatures and relatively high disorder values, although not unusually so. And I should mention that all other experimental properties of these materials don't seem to be all that sensitive to this level of disorder. Everything else checks out. It's just that this one aspect of the conductivity appears not to. And what it suggests is that there must be some crossover from this incoherent regime down into a coherent regime at very low frequencies. But the real question is, what sets the temperature and frequency scale at which that occurs? So I'll leave you with that question and skip this. Mention that I'm also beginning a program where I'm using the same ideas to look at metals close to a quantum phase transition. You can do this with, say, doping palladium with nickel, or looking at vanadium doped with chromium and a variety of other systems. Calcium ruthenium oxide and strontium ruthenium oxide are also a candidate, although there the disorder is a significant issue. And I guess I'll just leave you with that and skip to my acknowledgments, because I want to make sure I acknowledge the people who helped with all of this. Chris Weber, John Corson, and Joe Ornstein were actually the three people most heavily involved in the work that I presented to you. Joe Ornstein and Daniel Shemla both work on the same floor in Building 2 at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So for me as a postdoc, this is a really wonderful experience to be able to work with both of them. And I didn't get to talk to you about the work that I largely did with Shemla, and I think he's going to talk to you about semiconductors. But if you have questions about the nonlinear optics of strongly correlated electron systems, I have slides here, and I'm happy to talk about that with you. The films were meticulously prepared by Jim Reiner and Mac Beasley's group. Zach Schlesinger, of course, was a participant in this collaboration. And then Lior Klein was a postdoc at Stanford while I was a graduate student there. And he's also done a lot of transport work and other kinds of work on strontium ruthenium oxide. So he's been an important collaborator, as well as all the others in the Stanford group, like Kapitolnik and Ted Jabal. Thank you.
more questions.
Well, there are microwaves, but it's difficult to extract out this imaginary part from the microwaves. The imaginary part of the conductivity is decreasing as you go down in frequency. So the lower you go, the harder you have to work to see the evidence of the finite scattering time on your measurement. So in something like ITC superconductors, that can be done. I mean, there's a recent paper by out of Hardy's group where they were actually able, and of course you probably know about Doug Bond's work in the quasiparticle conductivity scattering in high TCs. All of that is possible because you have quite a large variation of that imaginary part in their frequency regime. If it's mostly happening, if it's gradual, or if it's largely happening at higher frequencies, it's more difficult. And then here, because it's a metal as opposed to a superconductor, the electrodynamics is entirely different. And so for metals, it's you always have both the real and the imaginary part. They're always about the same. And so one influences the other much more heavily in a measurement than you would have in a measurement of a superconductor, where it's easier to separate the imaginary part of the response from the real part of the response. Actually, what those microwave measurements were measuring were the real part of the response. They weren't measuring the imaginary part of the response. Yeah. What the spectral weight is under that peak? That's a good question. I haven't done that. We can do that after the talk. It can't be very big. That's right. That's right. You can, if you extract out an effective mass, you know, from the scattering time measurements that we did, and assume sort of conventional ways of defining the scattering rate, and compare that to the DC scattering rate that you would get by putting in a band value for the plasma frequency, then you get an effective mass enhancement of about 10. Now, whatever you measure in, if you were to perform the analysis that you just described, you would have to get an effective mass that's bigger than 10. That's for sure. And it would likely be, you know, possibly be at least an order of magnitude larger than that. But I'd probably say an order of magnitude larger. Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Okay. Yeah, there's been a lot of work on orbital fluctuations in these materials. It needs to be redone in this context because frequently when people are talking about orbital fluctuations, they're the sigma bonding orbitals, and here the dominant orbitals are pi bonding, and they have different properties. But there has been some work. One author that comes to mind is Lod, McCall Lod. There's some interesting similarities to the manganates, but there are also interesting differences. I mean, here all of the action is taking place in a single set of bands, and you don't have the super exchange or the double exchange model doesn't hold so naturally in this case as it does. Saturated, the moment saturated, it's at its low temperature value, not as a full. It's not a half metallic ferromagnet. That's what. That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's the point of this paper by Lod.
plots of the effective number of carriers as a function of temperature frequency.
Right.
You see that you have a lot of data where all frequencies and temperatures have to be
I have to say no, sorry. But it's a useful. I guess now that we're thinking in terms of this this crossover, I think that's probably. I agree. It's a fairly simple thing to do, and I think the reason. One thing that you could do actually, because our data fits reasonably well to this simple form. You can just do the integral on the form. That's what I did. And I'll do it on the data, but we were thinking in so much in terms of this simple power law form for so long, and then Mackenzie came out with this other data showing that it really didn't work when you extrapolated at the low frequency end. And so now I think it's time to go back and start taking a look at these alternative descriptions. So that's a useful point.